Thanks, everybody, for coming. We're going to start. So I am Rachel Deal. I'm senior news editor at Publishers Weekly, which is the main trade magazine for the book publishing industry. So today we've had panelists from a pretty diverse group across the industry, and each is sort of coming at the business from a different vantage point. So what I'm going to do is we're just going to give everybody a chance to briefly introduce themselves. Then I'm going to toss out a number of questions. And then at the end, we will open it up for questions from you guys. And if you want to tweet questions, I'll try to take those. Or if you want to tweet about the panel, it's Pub Models. That's PubModels. So we'll just go down the line. If you want to start, Jefferson.
Hi, I'm Jeff Rabb. I'm the one of the co-founders and creative director of The Atavist, and we've been in business for about a year now, and we are a hybrid publishing and software company. We publish basically what is being described as the e-single, which is a we publish long-form narrative journalism in the length, which falls somewhere between the longest the longest periodical piece and the shortest book. We publish into our own app, and we publish also through Kindle Singles and a series of other EPUB outlets. And the other side of our business is software, where we have been licensing our own platform, which we use for this publishing, and that's basically the long and short of it.
Good morning. I'm Brian Altunian. I'm CEO of Wowio and Studio W. For purpose of this conversation, it's been an evolving story. We started with a platform, an ebook distribution platform. We're with inserting ads into ebooks. Good. No booze. Good. I anticipate it. And we've really evolved. We've acquired some of our own content as well, and really looking at an evolving model that includes a broader digital distribution platform for authors and for published content, in a nutshell.
Hi, I'm Swana McNair, and founder of Creative Conduit. And Creative Conduit is a hybrid, a new type of firm. My background is a former literary agent, and then I worked in film on the studio side. So Creative Conduit manages intellectual property and partners with creatives and publishers and other media companies to develop strategies to take content across multiple platforms. And also do consulting for cross-platform strategies also to for multiple distribution channels and opportunities on the digital space as well.
Hi, I'm Molly Barton, and I'm Global Digital Director for Penguin. And I also oversee a company that I founded within Penguin called Book Country. I'd love to know, if it's okay, whether the people in the room are writers, publishers, so that we can sort of tailor what we're talking about to what you'd be interested in.
That's great. If we, a show of hands, who's a writer here? Okay, great. And a publisher? All right, great. And if media, journalist? Okay, super. That's a great idea. All right, thanks, everybody. Molly, were you done?
Sorry?
Were you done?
Yes.
Okay. So I guess just to get into this, there are some stats from Publishers Weekly. In 2010, ebooks accounted for roughly 8 to 10% of sales at the big trade houses. In 2011, ebooks accounted for about 15 to 20% of sales at the major publishing houses. So essentially, as this shift in consumption has been going on, there's been an exciting, at times scary, paradigm shift. And so, I mean, really what we're talking about today is all the content models that are changing. And we're going to be talking about everything from freemium content to new agenting models. So I guess I'm going to start with a question for Molly. So you're working at one of the biggest trade houses, one of the big six, at Penguin. And Penguin recently launched Book Country. And it aims to sort of to find talent and to publish new writers. So the question is, what's a big corporate publisher like Penguin doing launching something like Book Country?
Well, first of all, Penguin is owned by Pearson, and Pearson as an education company, it's a great fit between the two. We collaborate a lot on a technological way, and they sort of understand what we're trying to do because they're a book publisher as well. And they have an innovation fund. So I applied to the innovation fund to get the money to start Book Country because I wanted to do a number of different things. In some ways, Book Country harks back to Penguin's history. Penguin was founded in 1935 and was known at that time for popularizing the paperback. At that time, you know, very few books were published in paperback, and they were pulp novels. So Alan Lane, the founder, wanted to take hardcover books and make them accessible in terms of the price. So he wanted to make books as cheap as the price of a pack of cigarettes. In New York, books are cheaper than cigarettes. But really what he wanted to do was democratize access to high-quality literature. And so Book Country in some ways is democratizing access to the submission process and the publishing process because you don't need to be in New York, you don't need to know a literary agent in order to go onto the site and post your genre fiction and get high-quality feedback from other writers. Some established, some new, and learn about how to enter the trade publishing ecosystem if that's what you want to do, or use the site as a great place to make your work better and prepare to self-publish it. So it's a community for genre fiction writers, and we definitely are, you know, I have a couple people reading things on the site all the time and tracking what the community rates highly, and we have acquired some books at Penguin from Book Country, and another publisher just acquired two books that they discovered on Book Country. So that sort of model is working. A lot of the most writers on the site have at least 10 reviews from other people. So they're, and the level of conversation is quite high because I limited it to genre fiction. You can't just put put literary fiction or put journalism or put poetry. It's not about that. It's really focused.
Great. I mean, so now that you guys have been working on this for a while, are there certain pitfalls you're finding to working with writing communities? I mean, are there certain things that have been difficult?
Building community is difficult, and fortunately, the people that I hired to help work on Book Country and help bring it into the world are deeply invested in the community of writers that we were trying to serve from the beginning. So the community manager is a former literary agent. She also was a publicity director at Random House, and she worked in a bookstore for a long time. So she sort of understands the whole range of the value chain and is deeply engaged in social media. I mean, she has 70,000 Twitter followers. So she knows how to tap into the audience that we were looking for. But I would say, what are the other challenges? I think when you come from, or when you're sitting within a big corporation, the expectation for growth of a new venture might be out of whack with what's realistic, especially if you're trying to focus and not be all things to all people. So fortunately, I think that within Penguin, there's a great understanding of the fact that self-publishing and opening up tools that give back to some of our biggest fans. And the, you know, if you think about the people who are working on Book Country and improving their fiction, probably they're reading a lot of Penguin books. So the idea that we shouldn't just be selling books to them, we should be helping them try to achieve their dream and become part of Penguin, possibly.
And getting back to what you said about Penguin acquiring some books through the site and now other publishers, I mean, without having a crystal ball, I mean, do you think the other big corporate publishers are interested in launching similar things to Book Country?
There have been other slush pile accelerators, as they were called, in the past. But I really wanted to, as I said when I first started talking about Book Country today, focus and make sure the level of conversation was higher. Because if you just open up a site where anyone can post any writing, you know, people are writing about all kinds of different things. And that's one of the things that's most interesting about books. We were talking about this last night, how books are an entry point to so many different subjects. So if you want to have a high level of conversation, you need to reduce, you know, the categories that you're talking about. So that's the difference between Book Country and some of the other sites out there.
Okay. All right, we're going to move along. And so I have a question for you, Jeff. So moving on to sort of the atavist, in the past year or so in particular, there's been much easier access to shorter form content from on places like Amazon, and it's easier to get to, and it's more highly publicized for consumers. So can you tell us a little bit about how the company came about and how big a market you think there is for the kind of content that you guys are putting out in the market?
Well, the company... The company came about out of conversations between myself, Evan Ratliff, and Nick Thompson, the other founders, who are both journalists, and they had Nick was an editor at Wired at the time, and Evan was one of his writers, and they had just come off a very long article in which Evan had essentially tried to disappear, chronicled that whole experience, and they were both sort of buzzing about the experience and just wanted to try and find some way to continue publishing long form, hopefully digitally. The one of the main ideas that got us talking was this notion that in print, in magazines, there's always a fairly sharp constraints on space, and stories are cut down dramatically in some cases. A long-form story can be cut to a third or less of its original length. And then in other cases, if a magazine story is a great success, it will be turned into a book. And in that case, you actually get the opposite problem, where there may not be enough material to fully justify book-length exposition. So what we wanted to try was to publish only digitally, and by doing so, allow content to fill exactly the length it wants to fill. And so our stories range in length quite a bit, from the shorter end of long form to really quite long pieces. And we try not to constrain them at all. We try to just let them go to the length that feels natural. In terms of the question about how large the market is for this, Kindle Singles launched actually on exactly the same day we did, and you read quite a bit about them and about the whole sort of exercise. And I couldn't say really how large that market will be, but it seems like it's really touched a nerve, and it seems like a lot of authors who had previously been focusing primarily either on periodical writing or book length content have ideas or even have content sitting around in this new intermediate space and seem to be doing well publishing it.
So speaking to that, I mean, for an author then, and I know this is sort of difficult to say, this is sort of a two-part question. I mean, how much money do you think it's possible to make in sort of doing this kind of, publishing direct through you guys and publishing with the Atavist? And then, I mean, do you think that what you guys are doing is more, works better for established authors, for not established authors, or it's, I mean, it doesn't matter?
Well, in terms of what an author can make, the way we structure deals with authors is based on three levers, one of which is we make an upfront payment, which is not in advance. We never ask for anything back. It's a sort of a lump sum payment, and we ask our writers to take their expenses out of that. So we sort of try and find a fair number that will allow them to report the story fully, trying to keep costs down for their own sake, and so forth. Then we split sales usually right down the middle with our authors, and finally we also split film rights and do what we can to shop the film around. We have our own Hollywood representation. So it's sort of, because of the fact that we're splitting the proceeds directly with the author, it's kind of a wide open question. If a story does very, very well, it could be a big success for the author, and there have been a couple cases of that. If the story doesn't do well, they may make less than they would have made selling it to a print magazine. So it really, it keeps the author, it gives the author at least possibility for a big upside, and hope. And from our perspective, it keeps them involved in the process from beginning to end, and sort of incentivizes them to help us market the story. And also, because these stories are, because they're long and because they're not necessarily particularly newsy, these stories could potentially sell forever. There's no they're evergreen. You don't have the situation where a news story has value only for a month or so. So, you know, we don't know. All we know is, you know, the experiences we've seen. But there's at least the possibility that an author could do very well with any single story.
And do you have any numbers on sort of your most successful story date, or sort of an example of what's been the biggest hit coming from you guys?
The biggest hit we've had was a story we published called My Mother's Lover, which was by David Dobbs last year. And this story was, on his mother's deathbed, she told him and his sibling and his brothers that she wished for her ashes to be scattered in Hawaii next to Angus, to be near Angus, and they didn't know who Angus was. So basically, it's essentially a digital memoir in which the author actually reports on his own family life. He goes and he finds who this man that she had this affair during World War II with, finds his children, and sort of reports it almost like it actually was a news story, and just sort of goes deep into his own past. And that was our biggest story to date. We've had a couple others. We've had a crime genre story which did well, and we're always trying to figure out which genres do particularly well in this space. But it seems, also given just the length of these stories, they're all rather unique, and we try to market them all a little bit differently and just sort of see what sticks and see how you can get these things out there.
Okay, great.
Well, I can't tell you exact numbers, obviously, but last year we published 10 stories and sold over 100,000 copies.
So picking up on what Jeff was talking about, so I'd like to shift a bit and talk to you, Brian, about Wowio, which is a retailer with a unique business model, especially among online book retailers. So can you tell us a little bit about how you guys are different and sort of how you think your model opens up new opportunities for authors, creatives, different?
Sure. I think that, clearly we're in an evolutionary time in the publishing world. I mean, clearly the publishing path here at South by Southwest, with so many panels and so many folks involved, we're seeing that, obviously the digital world is having a huge impact on publishing. So, we've tried to position ourselves as being sort of at the forefront of that evolution and try to find new models that would work. Sometimes we had a lively conversation last night about some of this, but our goal in looking at I would say for a publisher and an author, knowing that there's kind of a restricted amount of distribution, and either you've got the top six publishers or you've got three, digital distribution platforms with Amazon, Apple, Google, and a few others, that there are a lot of limits to to the distribution play for published material. And we like to think of, what's happening in digital is the consumers of digital content want access to that content. They want it readily available, and they don't want to pay for it. So how do we find a way to distribute your books as broadly as you possibly can and have authors and have publishers be paid? So, we've been looking at the advertising model for such a long time, and exploring different ways of adding, that component to the conversation. I also don't like the fact, I personally, but I don't think we at the company like the fact that Amazon dictates how much money you make on the split, that Apple dictates how much money you make on the split. And as we had a conversation last night, They broadly, boldly claim that they offer 70%, but the reality is you really have to qualify to get that 70%, and it's about this this big of an opening to qualify. And so, you know, the amount of money that you can make distributing your books through the digital storefronts is, you know, it's a restrictive space. So the way we look at it is we actually let our publishers set their retail price at any price that they want, frankly. I think that that's what they should be allowed to do. We only take a processing fee, so we actually let them keep up to 100% less the credit card processing fee. So frankly, they don't have a channel conflict with the other distribution partners. They can price their books the same or wherever they want to make. Frankly, I want them to price it the same that they price it at Amazon, because if they're making $9.99 at Amazon and $9.99 on Wowio, they're going to actually net more money on Wowio, so they're hopefully going to drive their traffic to us. On the flip side is that if there's an advertising component, there's a per unit fee that they're paid on the advertising place. So the books are available for free to the consumer with an advertising component, and the publisher, the author, the creator is actually paid a piece of the advertising that's in the book. So for us, we think that that's a nice trade-off. You know, set the price wherever you want, and then if the book is available with an ad, that the books are free. And the way we've done ads, and again, as I sort of said earlier, I acknowledge the fact that advertising in books is sort of a controversial subject, but I don't think that anybody, us included, really wants to be reading a novel and having an ad pop up, and I don't think that anybody in their right mind would actually want to see that happen. We don't, for sure. There's ways to tastefully put advertising in books. We use a wraparound sponsorship kind of a model, so some of the books that are available for free on our site have an advertisement on the front cover and on the back cover. The nice thing about the digital play is that you've got, you know, you can put in transmedia elements, so, you know, the advertiser could put a video, you know, pre-roll in if you want, that's been easily skipped over, or live links that can be actually accessed. So, you know, the advertiser gets some value, you know, with the reader, because they can see that connection, they can see the metrics, pretty granular when it comes to clicking through on ads. So, you know, we think that model, again, I don't want to say it's revolutionary, but we think it's, you know, we've seen some success with that. I will say this, when books are available for free versus their retail price, we've seen the numbers, like, they're like 1,000 to 1 on free downloads of books versus retail price when the publisher is setting the price. So, you know, we definitely have seen a pretty significant jump in numbers when the material is available for free. And, you know, I will say this, we really started out in the textbook space thinking that, you know, let's find a way to bring textbook pricing down. I don't know how many of you have kids or recently graduated from college, but a textbook, you know, for $300 just seems insane. And so the idea that, you know, if we could find a way to subsidize textbook, the textbook distribution, that was definitely the first path. But unlike traditional publishers, or I should say even worse than traditional publishers, the idea of putting ads in textbooks, the textbook publishers have really resisted. So we kind of went the other way and found that there was a tremendous acceptance in the comic book and graphic novel space, because frankly, comic books and graphic novels have had ads in books for 50, 60 years. So there was really no resistance to the idea of ads in books. And frankly, with the number of comic book stores dwindling, and you know, unless you are a comic book publisher and your name starts with the letters Marvel, it's very tough to get distribution on a broader base. So the idea of looking at the digital platform as a distribution model really works for indie publishers of comic books and graphic novels, and we've seen a lot of success in that space. And so again, no resistance to the ad play.
Talking about free for a second, I mean, traditional publishers obviously are fighting very hard to keep prices as high as possible. I mean, isn't there a general fear whether, you know, if you're a publisher, if you're an author, if you give stuff away or if you price it really cheap, you're training the consumer that this is what your content is worth, and so it's harder to budge once you go too low, that you can't ever go high again.
Yeah, and I think that there's a play, and so, you know, again, these kinds of conversations require, I hate to use the word, we use a lot this week, that really require a paradigm shift in the thinking. Because I hate to say it, but traditional publishers, when you talk about unit sales, I'm not looking that way, you know, all they care about are number of sales of books. You know, and in fact, I've had conversations with publishers where they say, how many, we want books on shelves. And I don't know about you guys, but I think the number of shelves are dwindling. So, you know, the idea that keeping the price point up doesn't really benefit anybody, in my opinion, if ultimately your goal is to have your material seen by the largest audience possible. And so I think if you're a new writer, if you're a young writer, if you're a young author and you're trying to get the goal is to get your book out there in front of as many people as possible. And I don't know how many of you have tried to actually get a publishing deal. But it's not a fun process by any stretch. I think even they will acknowledge that it's not a fun process. Although Book Country is doing something a little bit different, which I think is very cool. But you know, the idea that you make your books available for free, you know, it's the freemium model. And frankly, I don't know anybody over the age of 40. I hate to say it, I'm included in that group. We're not the target demographic, anyways, for what we're talking about. We're talking about an evolutionary process in the conversation about publishing, where my children and their children are consuming all of their content on these devices. And frankly, they want access to content when they want it, how they want it, where they want it, at any given time. And so, you know, the free and that's right, they want it for free. So the idea is that, you know, we create a model that actually speaks into that. Here's the other thing, though, and I'll just say this, and I'm sorry to kind of bogard the mic here, but I'm trying to act younger than my age. I use a term bogard. But you know, the reality is, I use this as an example last night, and I tend to use this example a lot. You know, when I read, and I'm sorry, I'm a mass media reader. When I read Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons by Dan Brown, I wanted to go consume every single thing written by Dan Brown. And so if I become a fan of Dan Brown and I can get access to Digital Fortress and Deception Point for free or for a subsidized cost for $1.99, I'm going to become a fan of when his next book comes out. I don't mind paying full list price for that book because I'm a fan of Dan Brown. And so the reality is, well, we've seen a shift, and it kind of fits with what's happening here. A lot of the conversation around at South by Southwest, the conversation around branding and how you brand an image. And, you know, frankly, we think that authors are brands. We think that titles are brands. And I think if you become a fan of a brand, you're going to consume anything put out by that particular brand. And so the idea of giving away, you know, some of it for free, especially if there's an advertising subsidy so that the author, the publisher, is actually making something on free content, I think it's a win-win opportunity.
Can I rebut?
Yeah. Sure.
I knew it was coming.
Publishers care about a lot more than unit sales. Publishing is about finding content that's interesting to lots of different audiences, so it's not just about mass media. And the thing with price is we don't want to get to the place where a writer can't afford to sit alone in a room for 3 years and write really high-quality content for a specific audience, not a mass media audience. Some of what we publish is for the mass media. Some of what we publish gets made into TV and movies, and we're getting more and more into that. But a lot of what we publish is a fantastic experience for 8,000 people, not 80,000 people. So to be able to have an economy, a creative economy, where people who make things get paid by the people who enjoy those things is really important. That's not to say we shouldn't experiment, but in price and the way that we structure, you know, the remuneration of that creative work. But just to go back to, because I didn't fully answer one of your earlier questions about why Penguin has Book Country and what Book Country is, and I want to clarify something that I see in the Twitter stream, which is when I use the slush pile accelerator term, I was not talking about Book Country. What Book Country is a community for workshopping fiction, and it's also a self-publishing suite of tools to create ebooks and print books and distribute them out into the world onto Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all kinds of sites. And it's also, it's two other things. The storytelling innovation that goes on in genre fiction and mystery, science fiction, fantasy, thriller that influences a lot of other media is about mashing up categories. If you think about paranormal romance, which is the most popular category right now, in some ways it's a blend of romance and fantasy. But I'm sure that the first time that a traditional publishing editor received a paranormal romance novel, they were like, how do we market this? How do we describe it? How do we categorize it? Where will it sit on the shelf? And so the idea with Book Country is to get really expert writers in these categories talking to each other, reviewing each other's work, and speed up the innovation in storytelling and make the access to a platform to find readers more accessible to a broader group of people. Because I think that we still... we need more ethnic diversity in the population of people who are choosing books and the population of people who are writing books. So that's one of my hopes. And the last bit is about discoverability. The genre map on Book Country is a way that you can go in and find the exact book that you're looking for. So throughout, my theme is that there are niche audiences that need to be well served.
Okay, so just another question for you, Brian. How important is self-published and user-generated content to WOWIO and what you guys are doing?
Well, I mean, it is a big piece. We've been talking about adding a self-publishing model. I mean, you know, a lot of folks these days are doing self-publishing and looking at multiple distribution outlets. So. We like that. I think to Molly's point, the idea of user-gen content is the digital. That's the digital definition of that. User-gen content. You know, obviously there has to be some editorial control. So we don't really want just any kind of material up on WOWIO. But I think that again, people who are going through the, I think individual writers are trying to find avenues that fall outside the traditional distribution path. And I think that we've seen this in the music industry, and we've seen it in Hollywood studios as well, that you've got creative folks who are trying to go into the system as it's been created and finding ways, like, again, I respect what Molly's doing. I think what Molly and Penguin are doing really sets them aside and apart from the other traditional publishers pretty significantly. So I was joking about disparaging Book Country. I really think what you're doing is great. I think it's an acknowledgement that the traditional publishers have to do something different than what they've done. I don't think they all know what that is, and I don't think they all know what that means. Just like the Hollywood studios don't really know what that means, and just like the music labels didn't know what that means. But what's happening is that creative folks from all over the world, and you know this can't be just a U.S.-centric perspective, and it tends to always be in these conversations a U.S.-centric focus. Creative folks from all over the world are looking for outlets for their material, and they're looking, and so they're going to go. They're going to try the traditional route, and they're going to try other ways of getting their material out to the broadest audience. So, self-publishing is definitely an important area for WOWIO, and you know I think it should be for, you know, for any kind of distribution channel that we give a distribution outlet. We give a path for folks to get their material distributed.
And just to follow up on what you said, Brian, and sort of Molly jumped in on this too. I mean, you know, you said the goal for any author should be to get their content out there to the most number of people possible. But, I mean, they want to make money doing that too. And, I mean, also, you know, touching on what Molly said, I mean, the traditional model also, you're upholding price, but, you know, the Stephen Kings of the world allow debut author you've never heard of before to write his book too, right? So because Simon & Schuster can sell, you know, X million copies of Stephen King's book, they make enough money to allow for the person you've never heard of to write their book. So, I mean, doesn't that sort of not work with just getting as many people as possible with as low a price point or no price point as possible?
Well, again, I think, you know, like I said, it's an evolutionary conversation. So we could switch our hats and you know, we could all be studio executives and ask the same question. So, I mean, frankly, what's happening in the studio model is you're seeing $150 million budget films and $1 million budget films, and the gap between them is growing considerably. So some would say, well, you know, can't the studios continue to do the $150 million films so that, you know, we've got a bunch of people doing the $1 million films? I think you lose something in that conversation for the audience. What you have is you have then innovative creative people finding other ways for getting their material out. They go the indie financing route. They go the other, you know, they go outside of the studio system. They find ways, you know, they find ways to win Academy Awards for Best Picture outside of the studio system. You know, they find other ways of doing it. And I think that that's what we're creating an opportunity for people to find a way just outside the general system. I don't disagree with you, and I don't disagree with the traditional publishing model. I'm just saying that it is evolving, and these all publishers have to evolve. And I hate to use that term, evolve or die, but that is what is happening. And it's not from the top down. It's bottom up. Consumers are demanding this content, and they want access to it. And again, we've seen people download books on Wowyo from 260 countries. So we know that that free model works on a global level. So, you know, if that's ultimately what your goal is, you know, this is an alternative path. Did you want to answer that? I'm sorry. No, you haven't said anything today.
Yeah,
Swana is not here today,
actually.
She's waking up late.
We're getting to you, Swana.
So
you're coming at all this from a different vantage point, and sort of you've described yourself as an intellectual property manager. What does that mean, and how would it differ from a traditional literary agent, say?
Basically, a traditional literary agent, besides just you work with one author or one writer through the span of their career, and you're tasked with finding them publishing deals and linear. And why I say I work with intellectual property is because I work with the actual content, the actual idea, and from different phases. So whether it's just a seed of an idea, maybe it's an owned property by a publisher, maybe it's a proposal, and I take that and help really first evaluate, say, does it have the potential to be on multiple platforms? Is it good? Of course, that's the number one. What's the next step? What's the strategy to develop it in either a traditional model or a different model? And the reason I don't work with authors forever, sign a client agreement, is because I really do believe this affords me a way to work with people who might already have a literary agent or might have a representation or, again, an owned piece of content. And I work with them and manage the project and find the best solutions. And so you're almost sort of an advocate in a way in managing that property. So by working with individual properties, it offers more fluidity and offers more opportunities. And really, what I bring to the table in expertise is having a large reach in these different industries. So if it's publishing, film, brands, now digital and technology spaces, app developers. And so by being able to have a large reach, I can bring to the property, the content creator, the owner, new types of rights deals, new types of opportunities. So as Brian's talking about, absolutely, there's not just the traditional route anymore, but really being able to help assess that in a way. And so that, to me, because of course, you know, there's a big, you know, conflict of interest and there's rules about agenting and those things, that it just made more sense to work on individual projects.
And just if it helps, maybe briefly, I mean, so packaging is a term that sort of people within book publishing know. Some people not even within book publishing. Can you just explain, since you sort of did that before, just briefly kind of what that is and how it dovetails with what you're doing now?
Yeah, absolutely. So packaging is something that, coming from the film studio side, I see it as almost producing. So say you come with an idea. Maybe there's a writer already. Maybe it's a comic book. Maybe it's this. And it's putting elements together to build value, to build that brand, because every piece of content, I know this isn't new news, everyone should be a brand. You have to think about it that way, to add value to a potential deal, to a potential sale. So let's say if you so sometimes that might be bringing on, say I get a proposal for a story, we can see it's also, there's a toy component and there's a video component. So you might bring on Mattel in advance, or you might bring on the app developer in advance, and packaging it with elements that will build it if it's not necessarily a launched piece of content yet, so that when you are going to the traditional publisher, or you're going to the toy maker, or you're going to the film and TV rights, there's more there. And I think that's something that's really important in these days when it's really hard to sell books. It's really hard to sell linear. I think the way I don't work linear, so I think the old model and the rights deals for certain content, mind you, where you're making one deal and then you're going to make a book deal, a film deal, or a TV deal, you really lose out in the rights in that situation, again, depending on what it is. And so the more we can package in advance and add value to it, is creating value for when you do make those sales and opportunities in a market where having a platform, having a brand is very important. And you don't always have that when you're starting out. You just have a good idea. And that's what you should be starting with, is a great idea. And so it's helping bring that out into the awareness, into the community, to help a sale. So.
And by the way, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I mean, that's another, you know, and I don't want to sound promotionally, so I'm not going to. But we've acknowledged this on the Studio W side of our business, which is, you know, there's two aspects to, you know, to the digital world. One is monetization of your IP, and the other is creating brand awareness. And I think that what Swan is talking about is exactly key, and that's where this is all going in developing content as a brand and finding ways to So, again, going back to the earlier conversation, it would really suck if you were a writer and you got your first publishing deal, and then after you signed and you celebrated the publishing deal, realize that all the other ancillary rights of your project are now in the hands of somebody else who may or may not make a movie out of it, or may or may not make a television show. And so and again, I realize there's a place for that, but the idea is that now what the digital platform provides is a way to create yourself and your content as a brand and develop all of these other pieces, so that when it comes to getting a book deal or comes to getting a publishing deal, you're smarter, you're more educated, and you hold back the rights, or you make sure that you participate in those rights. And that's kind of the key, is to make sure that you participate across the board. And again, I've seen so many stories of authors who write a book and then, you know, they get an option deal 4 or 5 years later, and then, you know, the book is published, and then 3 or 4 years later, it's optioned for a movie, and then 6 or 7 years later, the movie's made. I mean, it's a long, long process, whereas if you look at what's available these days in the digital space, you can condense that time frame significantly and participate in the building of the brand and building the brand awareness around your content. So I think that, you know, Swan and I are sort of talking about the same thing, and that's really why this is an evolutionary conversation, is that this is what's available. So, and to Molly's point, it's not for all authors, it's not for all publishers, it's not for all content, but we are seeing that shift.
And I think that, but you as the writer or you as the publisher, that still might seem like, how do I even get to there? How do I get the right partner? How do I get those?
You hire Swana.
Exactly. So that's what they do, is because these larger projects take a lot of people. And for me, starting this business was in times of economic downturn, especially, you know, a year and a half ago with publishing, or a couple years ago, that there's a lot of proliferation and hyper growth and opportunity. And I think as everyone, as there's less people to do the very important jobs of publisher, you know, editing, marketing, and there's less people to focus, it's bringing those experts to the table, whether it's, again, the app developer or the editor or the publisher, bringing the experts to the table at the early stage to implement those strategies, but then also staying on to manage it. So managed collaboration is really a philosophy, and having that together so that you know from that your project is going to be done in a strategy that was long tail. So.
And Swana, can you just give some examples of maybe things you worked on and sort of what you did for that deal? And
yeah, a couple. One of, I guess it's not really a deal, but so one of the clients I work with is funnierdie.com, and they are an opportunity. Actually, I sort of aggressively approached them because I think they did such a great job on the space, again, building brands, offering free content, niche, you know, creating a niche about comedy, and thinking they should have a publishing extension. So we talked about a lot of different, and it's reframing the question about publishing too. You know, first, I think Funny or Die thought, well, books, you know, people don't buy books anymore, right? And we're like, no, yeah, they do. But as a digital company, so we came up with a strategy, because they are such great content producers, to what's the best way to have this publishing extension of your brand and give writers and comedy writers an opportunity to use their platform to give voices to themselves. So eventually there will be a book imprint. We put that aside, and we ended up just launching their first digital interactive magazine for the iPad, which is really exciting. And then the long-term sort of phase one and two, and working directly with Apple, working with their iBook store to talk about the short form that would come out of that content and the books that eventually come out of that content. And so actually having to create new types of deal structures for, and again, this is the first time Funny or Die is charged for content, which makes them nervous, you know, because their consumer is dictating. But so you really want to make sure that experience is unique and worth it. And to me, that's really exciting because it's a way of reframing using their platform to really the benefit of writers and comedy writers and giving them a voice and a place to publish. And another type of deal worked on is there's a writer-producer, Amit Zappa, and he has a deal at Disney Studios and also has a comic book company. And he and his wife wrote this really incredible children's multi-platform project called Star Darlings. And when Amit brought it to me, he'd already been through all of the publishers, and it was really put together like a deck, which has impressed me. It wasn't a traditional proposal. So this business deck, transmedia, cross-platform, had illustrations of the girls, had the basic components, but had outlined all of the toys, the cars, the Mattel. There was already an offer on the table, Mattel. And so we went to an app developer to talk about, would you be our partner in creating this interactive world and 3D component, and then went back to Disney. And it's reframing the conversation. So even though they'd passed on it before, saying, I'll come in and manage this project. So Amit Zappa has a literary agent. You know, he has a big agent at CAA. He has these things. But as the manager of this intellectual property, I'm packaging it in a way. And so that changed the conversation. You know, instead of meeting with the editor, you're meeting with the global publisher. You're meeting with the head of Synergy. They're flying them out. You're bringing your app developer into these meetings because you're talking about a cross strategy. Now, that what's the international play? And what was really unique about it is it took forever to do this deal because we said, let us participate. We'll give you part of the e-rights. We'll give you part of these things. We'll share with you. But we want to be involved, the content creators, all along the way. And they'd never done anything like this before. So I would go and have story meetings. They actually spent money on new types of proposals that they could use internally to get the TV people, to get everyone on board and put money into a pot, so to speak, up front. And that was interesting because we was helping do these deals together. And yes, you're managing and protecting the asset, but that alleviates some of the pressure off of the publisher. So we did eventually, after a year, figure out how to do that deal. But it was really exciting because it's a new type of opportunity. And so I stay on, help them. We hire writers, we hire all these people, and you're really building a brand from the ground up. And I really think there always needs to be someone who can keep their eye on that project on a daily basis. And it's not always going to be your publisher or your app developer or this, because they're doing a million other things. And so that's what it's someone who can, you know, really manage it in that way. So those are a couple kind of different things that we're doing.
All right, I have a question. I hope I get this right. From Brian J. Dixon. So he's asking how multiple format strategies apply to instructional nonfiction. I don't know. I think that's a question for you. I mean, and I would just add to that maybe, do you think in multi-platform deals there is a sort of a sweet spot, be it with fiction versus nonfiction, and also with people who have a huge platform? I mean, you know, Funny or Die is a big brand, and Amit Zappa is also famous, and he's somebody who is, you know, he's also sort of a brand in his own right. If you're just an author without a platform, can this work for you?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Again, it starts with a really great piece of content, a really great idea. It's always about the story. It's always about the characters, no matter if it's nonfiction or fiction. And I think that doesn't change, no matter how you do it. And it's difficult with a brand only because you are launching it and from scratch. And that's even more reason now with the consumption of tablets, with the digital space, that you can build these platforms in this way. And for example, I don't know, I work in the educational space a lot as well because of a personal interest in a lot of the children's stories we work on. So You know, I met with someone yesterday who's head of STEM, so of the research. You know, you're creating these elements of instructional. So with my slate of projects that are new IP that we'll be launching that aren't necessarily by famous people, some are published authors and some have platforms of their own. For example, one of them, we're actually doing the app first, the book app, and we're going down because it needs to launch as the component because it's a little bit lower risk. Of course, the cons are you need to know how to market it, discoverability, you're in charge of that, and so in dealing with Apple directly. And so what we're doing is it's a children's project, and so working with a developer in Shreveport who actually did the development work for a children's book app called The Fantastic Flying Books of Morris Lessmore, which the movie version just won the Academy Award, and they're a great company. And so we're all putting our money in. You know, you're talking to a content creator and you're saying, instead of going to get that advance, how about you pay for half of this? And we pay for half, but then the returns will be huge. And then when we can use that visual, we won't even finish the app, then go to get the publishing partner, then go get the toy deal all at the same time. But we've planned the strategy. And there's an educational component and an instructional component built into that because I do believe that you will want to use this in schools and that kind of thing. So I don't know if that really answered the question, but there is a way that instructional, but it's finding that category and channel to have that done. So.
Okay. And I guess we're sort of getting near the end. I mean, I have some more questions, but if you guys want to tweet the hashtag, I'm happy to ask your questions, or if you guys have a question, raise your hand, or you can go up to the mic, too. Okay, we have a question in the back? I guess just come up to the mic, maybe.
Hi, my name's Casey Francis. I'm with Thomas Nelson Publishing, and I just have actually a question for you, Molly. How much involvement does Book Country have with the self-publisher's editorial and cover design process when they do choose the self-publishing? And when and if they do accept the editorial assistance, how much resistance do you have for the suggestions that you all offer?
At this point, Book Country's self-publishing tools are ebook creation, physical book creation, and we provide distribution, and we provide the tools to create your own cover or upload a fully finished cover. So we are not selling editorial services at this time. We created the community with its focus to provide that element of, you know, high quality input. And one of the things, I started in publishing at Oxford University Press, and one of the interesting things about the academic publishing model is that there's a blind peer review. So if I wanted to acquire as an editor a new book on sociology, I would have to send it out to two experts in the field, most closely the, you know, subfield within sociology, most closely related to the topic of the book. And that's an interesting, you know, hybrid situation where you have experts who are not curators sitting inside the publishing house, but really closely connected to what the author is working on, giving you an informed view so that then you can make your editorial decision. So that's kind of what's going on with Book Country, where you get, you know, people most closely connected to whatever the subgenre of fiction is, weighing in advance of an editor considering the book, so maybe pushing the boundaries of what that editor is open to acquiring.
Hi, my name is Dan Pashman. I'm the host of the Sporkful podcast and blog and soon-to-be book. My question was about free books. I know, Mr. Altunian, you had said that when you make a book free, it gets downloaded a lot more. But I'm curious if you have data on how many of those people actually read those books and especially read them through to completion. Because I know with our podcast, we can see how many people listen all the way to the end or 90% through or 50% through. And I mean, a lot of people, I'm sure, would say, oh, free book, I'll take that. And might only read a few pages. So I don't know if you have information on how much free books actually get read.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I would love to find out how many people read their regular books all the way through. I don't have stats on that. So it's a good point. And I think that, again, I just want to clarify, because these are great, by the way, everybody who's tweeting, we're reading all of these questions, are awesome. On the free side, I agree. There's going to be a component of people who just want free because it's free. I look at it, though, as a little bit, again, a sort of a different philosophy. And I use the Netflix example, you know, pre-controversy, the idea that you pay a monthly fee for Netflix and then you put in your queue movies that you have always wanted to see but maybe would never actually get in your car and drive to the video store and go rent, right? So you actually may never watch those movies that are in your queue, but they're on that list of things that you've always wanted to do. So, I mean, I don't think people are just randomly getting, downloading books that are outside their interest. So, for the most part, I think that they're downloading books that are, either by a publisher that they know. Again, we've got a couple of larger comic book and graphic novel publishers. And so when they make their Origins books available for free, the fans of that publisher, and again, I look at publisher in that case as a brand. I'm talking about Top Cow Publishing, if any of you are familiar with the comic book space. Top Cow makes a lot of its books available for free. That fan base is going to download it because it's Top Cow. Whether or not they read it all the way through, I don't have metrics on it, but again, I don't think you're going to have many people downloading books just because they're free. It's going to be in their wheelhouse.
And I'll just say, to that point, actually, I've talked with a company that said they might have technology. I mean, I think these tracking things are companies here at South by Southwest who might not necessarily be talking to book publishers right now, but are using this technology with things that make more immediate sense, like advertisers and ad agencies. But I've been talking with people who are talking about, being able to embed something in an ebook where they can track when is this person reading it? How long are they reading it for? So that kind of thing. So I think that's pretty fascinating. But I'm going to take one Twitter question, and then we're going to go to you guys. This is a question from Space Cave World, which is a very good question because it's often talked about in the industry. So digital distribution and sort of paper books, obviously they cost much less to produce than... much more to produce than ebooks. So shouldn't that reduce the price of an ebook is their question.
Happy to take that one.
Yes.
Get it all the time. The paper printing, binding, shipping costs associated with print books have only ever been about 10% of the cost. The largest cost to publishers is always author remuneration. And we were just looking at the Penguin P&L, and the percentage that we pay to our employees and our authors is far and away our largest expense. So the talent that goes into helping add value to the author's work and paying the author for their own work is the largest cost. And so certainly ebooks should be cheaper because we don't have to ship them out and guess where the customer is going to be. The customer can come from anywhere. So that whole element of shipping books out and then having them return, which is a longstanding and bizarre element of the publishing business, that is going away. But until we can understand the breakdown and predict well the breakdown between physical and ebook, we're upholding the cost structures of two models.
Great, thanks.
And by the way, I'll just say, the piece of the conversation that hasn't been discussed is green and the impact on the environment. And again, I'm not going to, we don't need to go into all of that today. But the reality is printing, shipping, boxing, shelving, returns, all of that, there are other consequences that don't hit the P&L necessarily on the print side that the digital space takes care of.
Though books make up less than 2% of the paper used in the world. Yeah, all those devices in landfills. Anyway, yeah.
It seems traditionally in book publishing, the relationship with the consumer is kind of managed and owned, traditionally anyways, by the retail outlets. And I guess I'm curious with indie bookstores and Borders, for instance, kind of going under, what are traditional publishers doing to kind of recapture that relationship with the consumer?
With the consumer?
Yeah.
I think at Penguin we recognize that we're never going to be able to attract readers to the Penguin website as a place to find and sell books. I mean, we have relationships into niche audiences who are looking for certain things from us, but readers don't read based on publisher. So rather than trying to attract everybody to one place when they might want a Random House book or a Simon & Schuster book, and they don't even know that, they're just looking for the author, the story, the idea that they care about. Rather than try to push traffic in a way that doesn't make sense, we've invested in some companies that one is yet to launch called Bookish in the U.S., and the idea is to create a great place online for people to discover their next book and figure out what they want to read, because a lot of the ebook stores that are out there now are fantastic if you know what you're looking for, but if you're browsing and you want to sort of see all the best books on the French Revolution or things like that, it's not an easy kind of information to find. So that's Bookish, and then Penguin is also invested in a company called Anobi, which is out of London, and that's we acquired a Hong Kong based social network and expanded it into a retail site. So both of those are retail sites for ebooks, print books, and audiobooks.
And I just want to really quickly answer that, because I think it's a great question and it's a critical. I'm an in-house consultant for Hyperion Books, which is ABC, Disney ABC Television Group's adult trade imprint. And the retail space is a huge issue, and so it's actually actively looking for other ways in the retail space, such as partnering with, you know, Crate and Barrels or brands or retail stores that you wouldn't normally think of, and whether it's creating customized pubs or digital editions in those spaces that are really innovative and you have to be thinking about in a way that, because it's just the, and where the old days is, you know, special sales would be like, oh, it's only 2,000, you know, if you're selling your book at Michael's or Wilton's, it's only 2,000, it's only 2,000. Well, that really adds up. And so focusing more in a way of looking at alternative ways to have your book on the shelf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brands like Urban Outfitters and other places are getting really good at integrating book selling into the whole portfolio of things they sell.
Yes, my name's Christopher Allen. I am producing a steampunk Oz transmedia multi thing, and very
awesome.
Much my model is like Ms. McNair's Flying Books, which if you haven't seen the iPad app or downloaded the Academy Award winning video short, animated short, it's very, very moving. Related questions are, what came first? Was it a children's book first that then turned into the other mediums, and you developed the animation and things in parallel? And the second thing is, it is in all the forms that I've seen it, it's still very linear. It has A to Z type story. And have you looked at what's going on as far as with nonlinear storytelling, or where the reader, you know, can choose to follow, you know, the Tin Man, or follow, the Scarecrow?
No, that's a good. And just to clarify, so I didn't work on Morris Lessmore, but they are an inspiration, the development. But I can speak to it because I only want to do nonlinear. So yes, I agree with you. Where things, transmedia items are out now, haven't quite achieved the transmedia goal yet. And so with Morris Lessmore, I can say, though I didn't work on it, just working with their developers, they didn't even quite take it far enough, because they did have a traditional children's book deal. Their whole goal was to make the movie. You know, and they're a funded company. Louisiana government gives them funded the feature-length movie. So they took their illustrations, very talented group, obviously Pixar, ex-Pixar guys, had the developers create this app, create this world. That was the first item to launch. Came Apple's number one downloaded app. They made a ton of money because they cut out the middlemen. They canceled the book deal because they thought, well, wait, what are we doing here? And then they went off to, and then made the short. Now, if I was involved at that, where I think they went wrong is that it's a one-off. So there's one book. So as the story goes, when Apple called and said, what do you got going on for Christmas? And they're like, going to my mother-in-law's. And they're like, no, in the retail space. You know, like, so it's creating a reoccurring revenue, but not only that. And so creating series, serialization, but creating your partners, like you said. So I would bring in, I would keep the publishing partner. I'd keep those deals, and you keep the film, but you are creating it in a different area, and so that you want to connect on the different platforms. So you'd read, maybe the children's book print comes first, or maybe you see the app, and then there's a cliffhanger, so you know the next one is coming. So with our children's book project that we're developing, you know, you'll know the four others that are coming. There's games that you can buy inside the app, and hopefully the children's book, you know, the print version will come out at the same time. It'll be a different experience. So I definitely think the nonlinear is a great way, especially if you're launching new IP that isn't a brand name already, and so you're making ways for connecting the audience in different experiences.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good luck.
You're right. I don't think, do we have time for anything else? Or? No. All right, yep, we got to wrap it up. But thanks, everybody, so much for coming.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, really appreciate it.
Appreciate talking.